I should begin with a word of apologies. I've missed every session except this one. The reason is that I've been in Leeds. I just got back early this afternoon, so I apologize to all the other presenters for having missed their remarks. I'm going to read and talk through the short paper. Our remarks are deliberately being kept short because we know that it's been a long conference. But I'll start by saying that, as Ron has mentioned, I teach in the law faculty here at Cambridge, but most of my degrees and all of my lecturing and supervisions and research are in philosophy. I majored in philosophy as an undergraduate. I went to law school solely with the intention of improving my understanding of political philosophy. I've never had any intention of practicing law, and I amply lived by that. I never did practice law. And then I went on to pursue advanced degrees in philosophy. So two of my areas of specialization, moral philosophy and political philosophy, are well covered in the curriculum and the research of the philosophy faculty here. But my third area of specialization, on which I'll be concentrating in this presentation, legal philosophy, is largely left to the law faculty. So far as I'm aware, the only member of the philosophy faculty in recent decades to pursue much work in legal philosophy is Ross Harrison. And Ross himself is primarily a political philosopher. But in this respect, in leaving legal philosophy to the law faculty, Cambridge is similar to the vast majority of other British and American universities. There are a few exceptions, Stirling in Scotland with Anthony Duff and Sandra Marshall, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with Jerry Postmer, McMaster University with Will Wallachow. In all of those cases, legal philosophy is pursued primarily in the philosophy department at each of those institutions. But for the most part, universities in the English-speaking world consign the philosophy of law predominantly to law faculties. Though inevitably, of course, there are overlaps with topics in other areas of philosophy, most notably in ethics and political philosophy. So the situation just recounted, that is, the fact that legal philosophy is consigned primarily to law faculties, law departments, is due not least to the similarities between law and philosophy. Like philosophy, law as an academic discipline, and indeed also as a practical institution, is highly self-reflective and concerned with its own history, indeed in some respects obsessively concerned with its own history, especially in a common law jurisdiction. In addition, law as an academic discipline sets a premium on rigorously articulated argumentation and on the elaboration of subtle distinctions. In many respects, what philosophers call thought experiments are what jurists call hypotheticals, but the reasoning is strikingly similar in many ways. Moreover, major philosophical issues arise in many areas of the law. For example, by no means the only example, the law of evidence involves many of the problems with which epistemologists grapple, and quite a few of the distinctions drawn in that area of law a parallel to those drawn in the epistemological literature. Though there are also some salient differences, because considerations that are operative in a courtroom are rather different from those that obtain in many other contexts of knowledge acquisition or knowledge pursuit. In particular, a clear-cut result is required in the context of a courtroom, whereas the pressures for clear-cut results aren't similarly prominent in many other settings. It's not surprising, given the affinities between the law of evidence and epistemology, that some distinguished epistemologists, such as Larry Laudan and Susan Haack, have produced important work on general topics in the law of evidence, very important work. Because of these affinities between law and philosophy, the location of legal philosophy in law faculties is quite sensible. given that both the methods of reasoning and the substantive issues in the philosophy of law are far from unfamiliar to jurists, the major British and American law faculties are natural homes for the jurisprudence courses that are offered under their auspices. I should note this term jurisprudence, it's used in different ways. Sometimes it just means legal thinking generally, but usually when it designates a course on offer, either here in Cambridge or virtually anywhere else, it signifies the philosophy of law. Also usually some topics within political philosophy, which I'll be mentioning. But the philosophy, jurisprudence and the philosophy of law are essentially interchangeable designations. So law faculties then are natural homes for these jurisprudence courses. Indeed, at Oxford and at several other British universities, Manchester, a couple of the London colleges, jurisprudence is a mandatory course for every law undergraduate. Nonetheless, the philosophy of law is indeed a branch of philosophy. It overlaps substantially with political philosophy and moral philosophy, and to a lesser extent with most other domains of philosophy, including formal logic. There's been a lot of work done on jural logic in the philosophy of law. But the philosophy of law addresses a number of distinctive topics and concerns. Very roughly, and this is extremely rough, the field can be divided into two main components: the conceptual or theoretical explanatory side and the normative or prescriptive side. Although there's a huge amount of interweaving between those two categories, they can usefully be separated for heuristic purposes, though when any inquiry is pursued in depth, it turns out that the distinction between the theoretical explanatory and the prescriptive becomes highly problematic. When legal philosophers pursue a conceptual or theoretical explanatory inquiry, they seek to explicate the nature of some major entity or property that is involved in the operations of legal systems. Perhaps the most famous such inquiry concerns the nature of law itself. Legal positivists, including me, have long insisted on the separability of law and morality. If I had to state what legal positivism amounts to in a nutshell, in a single sentence, it would be that it insists on the separability of law and morality, though that doesn't begin to convey the complexities and multifacetedness of the debates in which legal positivists and their opponents engage. That is, legal positivists maintain that there are no significant necessary connections between the legal domain and the moral domain, though there are typically any number of contingent connections between those domains. In opposition to legal positivists are natural law philosophers of many stripes, who contend that law and morality are necessarily linked in important ways. Debates between positivists and natural law thinkers have loomed large in the philosophy of law for centuries, going back at least to the early modern period, in some respects to ancient times. partly because the specific foci of those debates are multifarious, the debates have proved to be long-lasting indeed. The precise tenor of any claim about the relationship between law and morality depends upon the relevant contrast class for the moral realm: morality versus immorality, morality versus prudence, morality versus descriptive factuality. And then there's yet another contrast: morality versus the non-moral. So very, very briefly, just to give a sense of some of these debates. When morality is contrasted with immorality, among the claims put forward by natural law theorists in support of the view that there are important necessary connections between law and morality would be the claim associated with Augustine and many other thinkers since then, that an apparent law, an ostensible law, something brought forth as a law through the normal procedures, is not genuinely a law if it falls below some threshold of moral legitimacy or moral worthiness. This is in many respects, the most familiar position taken by natural law philosophers. It's still taken by some philosophers in the present day, though it's largely been overshadowed by other respects in which law and morality are said to be necessarily connected. But in the classical debates between legal positivists such as Jeremy Bentham and John Austin and others, and natural law theorists such as William Blackstone and others, this claim about the status of ostensible laws as genuine laws was the central point of contention. But there are other claims as well that have been put forward by natural law theorists when morality is contrasted with immorality. So another claim would be that every legal system, simply by virtue of its nature as a legal system, performs certain morally worthy functions, and therefore the status of a law, simply by virtue of its status as such, imposes a prima facie moral obligation of compliance with its terms. That's another position that's been put forward by a number of natural law theorists. Legal positivists like me spend our time seeking to rebut these sorts of claims, but these are a couple of the sorts of claims that have been put forward by natural law theorists. Now, when morality is contrasted with prudence rather than with immorality, one of the principal claims put forward by natural law theorists is that the attitude of commitment evinced by legal officials, legal governmental officials, when they adhere to the rule of law, their allegiance to the rule of law, necessarily is based on moral considerations in the sense of non-prudential considerations. They maintain that that there's no credible legal system in which there may be utterly fanciful legal systems, but according to this view put forward by natural law theorists, there's no credible legal system in which the officials would adhere to all the procedural requirements of the rule of law on the basis of considerations other than non-prudential considerations. That is, they couldn't be acting selfishly out of their own perceived interests. That's a claim put forward by many contemporary natural law theorists, including some of my colleagues here in Cambridge. And I've engaged with that claim at length, seeking to show why it's unsupportable. And there are other also theses associated with the claim that law and morality are necessarily connected when morality is contrasted with prudence. But given the limited time here, let me just go on now to morality versus descriptive factuality, that is, morality versus the non-normative. Well, here, one of the most prominent contemporary debates about the separability of law and morality, when morality is understood in contrast with descriptive facts, would be Ronald Dworkin's arguments against legal positivism, where Dworkin maintains that the process of ascertaining the law in any given jurisdiction is always an enterprise of moral deliberation and moral judgment. It can never rely solely on factual inquiries concerning whether legislators have voted in certain ways or whether judges have articulated certain rulings. According to Dworkin, those sorts of factual inquiries are never sufficient to determine what the law is on any given point in any particular jurisdiction. Instead, what is also necessary, he doesn't deny, of course, that those factual inquiries are important, but he maintains that they must always be combined with moral judgments concerning the underlying moral principles of the regime of law in any given jurisdiction. And again, legal positivists like me have sought to rebut Dworkin's position on that issue. Now, there are many other controversies between legal positivists and their opponents. I could give several lectures on that topic, but since I'm trying to give a short lecture on other points within the philosophy of law as well, I'm going to move on. and say countless further conceptual or theoretical explanatory inquiries in legal philosophy pertain to other major entities or properties that are operative in legal systems, rights, liberties, authority, duties, and so forth. I have time here to broach only one of these other relevant debates. So let's take analyses of the nature of legal rights. Well, those analyses, for the past couple of centuries at least, have divided into two broad camps: versions of the interest theory and versions of the will theory. Strictly speaking, these are not theories of rights. These are theories of rights holding, that is what it is to hold a right. But they're usually called theories of rights, so I just follow the common usage here. Proponents of the interest theory, and I'm one of those proponents, affirm that a necessary condition for the holding of a legal right by any person P is that the duty correlative to the right, when actual, normatively protects some aspect of P's situation that is generally beneficial for a human being. The analysis can be extended and typically is extended to cover collectivities and some non-human animals. But the way I've just stated it, I focused on an individual human being. So again, a necessary condition for the holding of a legal right by P is that the duty correlative to the right, when actual, normatively protects some aspect of P's situation that is typically beneficial for a human being. Interest theorists also contend that P's being competent and authorized to waive or enforce the duty correlative to a right is not a necessary condition for P's holding of that right. Proponents of the will theory, the opposing theory, contrarywise, maintain that a necessary and sufficient condition for the holding of a legal right by P is that P is both competent and authorized to waive or enforce the duty correlative to the right. So whereas interest theorists maintain that being competent and authorized is neither necessary nor sufficient, will theorists maintain that it's both necessary and sufficient for the holding of a legal right. Though these two competing analyses, the interest theory and the will theory, are extensionally equivalent over a wide range of cases, they diverge in application to the cases that receive far more attention than those on which everybody agrees. We philosophers may strive for agreement, but we find it really boring when we attain it. So we pay hardly any attention to the cases on which we agree. We, of course, put forward our theories in the hope that this will elicit a consensus, but if it ever did, people would move on to some other area of philosophy. So let us move on then to the normative or prescriptive matters that engross legal philosophers. These matters belong to the domain of political philosophy, strictly speaking, but because they centrally involve legal institutions, they are frequently addressed by legal philosophers as well. Among the issues of this sort, these are just a few, but among the issues of this sort are some of the following. To what extent are human activities properly subject to legal regulation? The sort of issue addressed by John Stuart Mill, among many others. Who, legislatures or courts, should have the final say in determining whether people hold fundamental legal rights to be treated in certain ways? And of course, that issue implicates deep questions of democracy, democratic legitimacy, and the like. Is there any comprehensively applicable moral obligation to comply with legal requirements? What is the appropriate general basis for the imposition of punishments? That is, on what basis can legal institutions, in a legitimate and perhaps also obligatory fashion, impose punitive measures on malefactors? When can adjudicators and administrators legitimately deviate from requirements of procedural justice in order to promote the attainment of substantive justice? Well, those are a few of the normative or prescriptive questions addressed by legal philosophers. And although some of these questions can be construed as jurisdiction-specific, that is, asking about, say, the constitutional situation in a particular jurisdiction, philosophers construe these issues in abstraction from any particular jurisdiction, even if they ultimately conclude that the answers to some of these questions can legitimately vary to some degree across jurisdictions. The question about punishment can serve to illustrate the complexities of the normative matters that are pondered by legal philosophers. This will be the only normative question that I discuss. Some philosophers take the view that a punishment is morally justified insofar as it deters future criminal activity more effectively than would any less severe sanction. For such philosophers, a ceiling on the severity of the type of punishment for any specific type of crime is given by a balancing between the increases in utility due to a punishment's crime-reducing effects and the decreases in utility due to the suffering which a punishment imposes on convicted criminals and the apprehension which the punishment elicits in the broader community. So this approach to punishment, this deterrence-oriented approach to punishment, has been prominent at least since Jeremy Bentham and in some respects well before Bentham, but it's certainly associated broadly with the utilitarian position in moral philosophy. Other theorists contend that punishments are morally justified insofar as they are deserved or insofar as they are necessary to reaffirm the rights and dignity of victims, the so-called retributivist position. Still others maintain that punishments are morally justified insofar as they express a community's revulsion toward various modes of misconduct. They commend this denunciatory role of punishment both because it solidifies the disinclination of people to engage in criminal activity and because it sates and thereby diffuses people's instincts for revenge against criminals. So this denunciatory theory, associated perhaps most famously with James Fitzjames Stephen, and a ferocious opponent of John Stuart Mill in the second half of the 19th century, although Stephen includes a lot of language about hatred and the virtues of hating criminals and so forth, it's a theory with a serious moral purpose. That is, it's a theory that's aimed at educating the citizenry in proper mores and also at averting private acts of retaliation or revenge. Further theorists claim that punishments are morally justified as means of incapacitating wrongdoers from committing additional misdeeds, while still others declare that punishment should be replaced with a regime of rehabilitative measures, or at least that one of the principal aims of any punishment should be that of rehabilitation. The preceding discussion does not exhaust the positions taken by philosophers on the matter of punishment. There are still other rationales put forward, and indeed I myself have put forward a rationale which I haven't yet mentioned at all. Especially since these positions that I've just outlined can be pluralistically conjoined in any number of ways. And indeed, my own view is that any overall account of punishment that extends across the full spectrum of crimes and sanctions would have to be pluralistic to be plausible. But the discussion, though clearly highly selective in its focus, conveys a sense of the multifacetedness of the normative topics that are the foci of many of the quarrels among legal philosophers. To the extent that any progress is made in tackling these topics, it occurs through wide-ranging disputation. Given that most legal philosophers have been trained both as philosophers and as lawyers, the numerousness and persistence of the disagreements among them are amply predictable, because if there's anyone more tenacious than a philosopher in arguing and more bloody-minded in refusing to give way, it's a lawyer. So let me just say very quickly, in winding up then, a word about my conception of philosophy that's implicit in these remarks. I take a view of philosophy which I'm certainly in the analytic camp of philosophy. That is, I have read quite a bit of continental philosophy, and some of it, like Nietzsche's work, certainly appeals to me. But in general, though, I was trained in analytic philosophy, and I'm an analytic philosopher. But some analytic philosophers now, who are still called analytic philosophers, would now view their endeavors as largely continuous with the empirical sciences. I take a somewhat more old-fashioned view of philosophy, which is I still see it as the search for necessary and sufficient conditions for the existence of certain entities or properties. And that approach to philosophy is implicit in my remarks. But I of course, teaching at the university where Wittgenstein taught, accept that there are some phenomena for which that sort of analysis is inappropriate. But the overall approach to philosophy implicit in my remarks would be as I've just stated it. So thanks.
Okay, thank you very much.